From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak. And this morning we speak first with University of Michigan geology professor Nathan Niemi about the geology field camps that his school and other Midwestern universities hold every summer right here in Park City, Utah, and surrounding states. Think of it as the best field trip ever.
Then we are joined by Jessica Swanson. She is assistant professor of chemistry at the University of Utah, and she's doing fascinating and important work on methane-eating bacteria and researching new ways to remove excess methane from the atmosphere.
These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
You may have noticed the big white vans parked outside the Chateau of Prey Lodge every summer. Or maybe you saw the throngs of college-age kids enjoying themselves in the library field. But have you ever wondered who they were and why they were here? Maybe you came across a group of students studying rock formations at the top of Guardsman's Pass, but you weren't quite sure what they were actually looking at. Well, these geology students from universities in the Midwest are on what I like to call the best field trip ever. Every summer, groups of senior year geology students ascend on Utah and Wyoming to see and study firsthand the landscapes, formations, and geology that they have only seen in books. Here to tell us more about the field camp is Nathan Niemi, professor and director of the Camp Davis Field Station through the University of Michigan. Nathan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So let me ask you, I mean, I studied geology down here at the U and we were traipsing around locally every weekend, every day it seemed like. But why do you guys have to come out here, all the way out to Utah?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's been a tradition of universities on the East Coast and the Midwest to have summer geology field courses. It's probably driven by a couple different reasons. One is the weather for many of us is not particularly amenable to being outdoors, particularly for long periods of time during the regular fall and spring or winter semesters. It's also where I'm in Michigan, the geology is incredibly monotonous. To show the students the diversity of geology they've learned in books, we really have to travel somewhere where that diversity is expressed at the surface of the earth in Utah and Wyoming and Nevada and the rest of the Western United States are really an incredible place to go do that. And so we take the opportunity to come out and teach students in the field in the Western United States.
How long are you out here every summer and how many students do you bring with you?
Yeah, our field station is a little bit unique. And I should say there's a whole variety of ways colleges do this. Some like the University of Michigan, we own our own land outside of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. We have a permanent field station with dining halls and classrooms and cabins that the students stay in. Some, as you've mentioned, rent out condos in Park City or use dormitories in universities. University of Utah rents out dorms for students to do field camp. Snow College in Ephraim is known for doing this as well. And then others actually just camp on Forest Service property with tents while they're doing field camp. So they last typically between 4 and 6 weeks. And class size is going to depend on the university, but you're managing a lot of students out in the natural environment. So they'll typically be maybe 24 students. Our field station offers 6 to 7 classes every summer. And they range from introductory students who this may be their first class ever at the University of Michigan. They come out and learn introductory geology, all the way up to, as you mentioned, the more common kind of senior level course where it's kind of a capstone class for students who are wrapping up their 4-year degree in geology or the earth sciences.
Well, if you haven't seen the white vans around, or as I have encountered out on the trail many times, these groups of students studying geology, you might not know what is so interesting about our geology here. Of course, in southern Utah, it's pretty obvious, but sometimes it takes people from outside to make us aware of what we have right here. So talking about the Wasatch Back, for example, or the Wasatch in general, talk to us a little bit about our geology here and what makes it so interesting.
Yeah, that's a great question. There's kind of this belt of geology that runs down through western Montana, western Wyoming, down through kind of eastern and central Utah. It just has this extraordinary diversity of geology for students to go see. So you could go up to the Uinta Mountains and you could look at rocks that represent when the Earth was covered with ice over a billion years ago. These are the rocks were being deposited underneath these ancient glaciers. And then for long periods of time, the Western United States was covered by a very shallow and quite warm ocean. And it deposited all kinds of limestones full of fossils. Up at Mount Timpanogos would be a great place you could see this expressed in the area around Utah. And then we went from this kind of passive, quiet ocean to this very active mountain building scenario. And so this big mountain belt got built in the Western United States. An analogy would be like the modern day Andes Mountains. And so it would have had volcanism associated with it, would have had big thrust faults that are shortening the crust. And those are all exposed in and around Utah. And the sediment being shed off of those mountains is also preserved throughout the area, for example, around Heber City. And then kind of the last stage is now the Basin Range is widening the Western United States. So every year Reno gets about an inch further away from Salt Lake City. And that's what makes the Wasatch Valley. The Wasatch Front there is sitting on one of these big, what we call faults that are pulling the earth apart. And the record of past earthquakes is really, really visible there as well. So we go and show students, here's evidence of earthquakes along the Wasatch Front a couple thousand years ago. And then you had the Great Salt Lake, which used to be Lake Bonneville, and the incredible floods out the north of that. So the time scales and the diversity is just incredible. Go down towards Delta, and there is perhaps a lava flow, volcanic eruption so young it would have been witnessed by Native Americans. And so it's just a lot of really, really cool stuff to see, representing all kinds of geological processes, representing a tremendous range of the geologic timescale. And to be able to do this all in just a couple hours drive, you can go see this and then, you know, move a little bit further and see something completely different. That makes this kind of belt, and we have the same thing up where we are near the Tetons. With very short trips, we can just really put the students in a completely different environment and make them think about a different set of geological and earth-related processes.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Nathan Neamey. He's the professor and director of the Camp Davis Field Station through the University of Michigan, bringing groups of students to the West to study geology. And Nathan, how do you characterize the differences between the area around the Tetons and the Wasatch?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are a lot of similarities in some cases. Both the Teton Range and the Wasatch are created as a result of what I've mentioned, this basin and range extension, a really significant fault that is displacing. The earth lies at the front of each of them. In that case, they're quite similar. The geologic history in what we call the Paleozoic, the beginning of life time period, is more or less the same. I could take the students to the Wasatch and show them rocks that are 500 million years old. And if I took them to the Tetons, they'd have no problems identifying those exact same rocks. We're covered with a big ocean. There's great homogeneity. Today, up around the Tetons, a little further north of the Tetons, we have this huge active volcanic system, Yellowstone National Park. And there was a system like that actually in the past in Utah and along the Wasatch Front. A part of it that I'm probably your readers or your listeners would recognize would be, you know, Bingham Canyon and the Bingham Pit. About 30 million years ago, there was this volcanic activity, and associated with it was this immense mineralization, particularly of copper. And this big copper mine now sits, you know, out to the west of Salt Lake City. But another volcanic stock, we call it a small hot magmatic body, sits right at the top of Alta and Brighton ski resorts. And as it came in and intruded into the Earth's crust, it baked and cooked the rocks into which it intruded. And it's a really fantastic, the geologic term is a metamorphic aureole. But this kind of ring of cooked rocks around this stock up by Brighton. And that's a really classic place that students go and study. So we've driven down there from the Tetons because it's such a world-class example of metamorphism. And all the students who are staying in Park City or staying in Salt Lake would come up and see that. The other thing that you have a great record of in Utah that we don't have further north is the Mesozoic, which is the time period of the dinosaurs, right? And so Dinosaur National Park there on the side of the Uintas is just an absolute classic place to go take students to talk about the history and the evolution of life. And to see those dinosaur bones sticking out of the side of the canyon wall where you're taking the students on a hike down through the park is really remarkable.
I know my excitement when I see some of these formations for the first time, and I grew up in this area. How excited are these students when they first encounter the dinosaur bones sticking out of the wall or that lava dike that comes down through the main Teton?
Yeah, they tend to be really, really excited. And, many of them are excited by the geology. Many are just overwhelmed by the natural beauty of this part of the world. It's not uncommon that if you come from the Midwest in a public institution, that you will have a student who has never been west of Chicago. They've never come out and seen the mountains. And so for many of them, it can be an intimidating experience. Right? They haven't seen something like this before, but it can also be a really eye-opening experience. And I think, one of the best things is when they see all of these features that they've looked at in textbooks or, seen in videos before, and now they're standing there looking at it and can walk around it and really study it. It all kind of clicks for them. And that's one of the really exciting parts about doing this.
I know that I've met a number of people, including a geology professor at the University of Utah that we interviewed a few months ago that had come out through University of Michigan or other schools for field camp and decided to stay, never went back. So you're talking about these kids, they're going up, they're studying, they're observing. What is it they actually do besides just look at these amazing formations?
Yeah, that's a good question. At the upper level, when we're talking about seniors and the most common of geological field courses, they're kind of mini projects. They'll have a little project that they work on for 4 or 5 days in a particular geological setting with a particular set of geologic units, and then they'll move on and do another project. And it's really a blend, ideally, of two different things. One, you're trying to teach them some practical skills that they may use further on in their career. So, how do we use this particular equipment for surveying or for measuring in the field? This is a practical skill you could take on and to a job. But the other thing I think makes field camps really unique and interesting for students is you also teach this whole range of soft skills that you don't think about so much. But you have a group of students who have to figure out how to work together in the field to achieve a goal. You're going to tell the students, you have 4 or 5 days to work on this project, and then you're going to have to wrap it up. And you're going to wish you had 4 or 5 more days, but you don't. And so you're going to have to decide, where am I going to spend my time? Where am I going to go and make my observations? And then the wrap up for each of these projects is they're going to have to defend what it is they think they've observed. And they'll defend it by making products, a geologic map maybe, or a cross section of what they think the interior of the earth looks like, a written report, or maybe they just have to talk to the fellow students in a conversation and explain what their interpretation is. And so those set of skills of having to do time management, and having to think about planning your day to get the observations you need, and then having to defend your interpretations, even though you don't have as much data as you kind of wish you had, are really important soft skills that we build when we teach field camps that can be really valuable no matter what students do. And not all students who study geology, of course, go on to become geologists, but they can take these skills to almost any pursuit that they go on to do, and hopefully they're really helpful and useful to them.
Well, it all must be so exciting and fun. And I'm just wondering, can you give us an overview of what types of jobs students are getting these days? I mean, it seems like every time I speak to a geology major, they're, either going into, some sort of mining or the petroleum industry somewhere, but what are they doing?
Yeah, that's a great question. Petroleum at the current time is on a bit of a lull, I would say. I think that they are overexplored and underdeveloped in terms of petroleum resources. I think they know where more of them are than they've pursued. So there's not a lot of geological work in as much geological work in the petroleum industry right now as there is, say, engineering work. But with the kind of the revolution towards green energy and clean energy, whether it's wind turbines or solar panels or electric vehicles, there's a whole need for resources from the earth at a scale that we haven't pursued them before. So mining industry in many ways is coming back, particularly for lithium or other metals that we need in order to build batteries, build electric cars. The environmental realm remains a really critical avenue for many of our students who work environmental consulting. And the other is that's really kind of burgeoning right now is geospatial skills. So students who know how to work with data in a computational system that's geographically aware. They know where data is. It can compare data to one another. And so environmental planning is one of the big fields that students are going into as well.
Really interesting. Well, it's funny because we've done some interviews recently on the rare earth minerals and all of the mining that happens around the world now for our thirst for electrifying the world, it seems. What are you finding in the Western U.S. in terms of those resources, and how much, you know, more mining do you expect that we will see in Utah, in Wyoming, in the West in general?
Yeah, I think it's going to, you know, as I said, the geology is really diverse. And so that diversity is going to really change what happens from state to state. There's a lot of talk right now about lithium mining in Nevada and some of the old, what used to be lakes that are now dried up. So lithium in these lake beds. People will certainly be pursuing in Utah and Nevada and the other Western states, examples like the Bingham Pit. Are there other places we can get copper? Are there other resources like that that we might be able to find? And then a little further afield, one of the ones that they have the hardest time predicting are the rare earth metals and the rare earth elements. And there's a rare earth element mine in California that had been dormant or really not particularly active for a number of years that's really coming back to life. And there's a lot of emphasis being placed right now on rare earth element. Where can we find them? What's a template for looking for them? It's a market that's not particularly well developed in the United States, but it's a really, really important one for things like magnets and wind turbines.
Well, getting back to all of your big field trips, I see the geology here in Utah and Wyoming. I've lived up in Jackson, but then you think Nevada, and I think a lot of us think of Nevada as just what we have to go through to get to California. But you say your students spend a lot of time in Nevada. Where and what are you finding?
Yeah, so Nevada has got some quite beautiful geology. The northern half of the state is fantastic. There's some areas, Great Basin National Park is fantastic. And then just a little bit to the west of there, as you head over towards Elko, the Ruby Range is a fantastic range. And it uniquely, as I talked about this idea of normal faults and as they extend and pull apart the Earth's crust, they bring deeper rocks up towards the surface. And the Ruby and the Snake Ranges in Nevada are an extraordinary example where rocks that had been down at 15 or 20 kilometers depth in the earth have now been exhumed all the way up to the surface. And not just small pieces, but huge tracks. And so to be able to take the students and say, you know, here's what the middle of the Earth's upper crust look like. Here's an example. And they just deform, they behave in completely different ways because they're really, really hot. They fold and move like toothpaste kind of at those conditions. And so those are some places we go that are really, really fantastic to take students to show geology in Nevada.
Do you have a favorite place of all the places that you go?
Oh, man. I started off my career as a geologist and a PhD student working in Death Valley, right on the border of Nevada and California. And it still remains a place that is just very near and dear to my heart in terms of geology in the West United States. It's just the absolute extreme of no vegetation. It's all rocks. It's really just a fantastic place to work.
That's wild. It's funny. I've never been to Death Valley, but so many people who go there just think it is the coolest place ever. And I suppose that it is maybe the stark contrast to, you know, what looks living.
Yeah, there definitely is that. But, you know, I would spend months at a time backpacking in Death Valley while I was doing my work. And what's kind of cool is just how the life is hidden in these little corners. You know, it looks barren, and then you realize, no, that there's life everywhere. There's little pools of water here in the spring, and they're full of, you know, little tadpoles, and the birds are there in the bushes. But it's very unique in that sense. You have to go looking for the life to find it there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you are on sabbatical now, and you're spending a year with your family in Western France, which is interesting in and of itself. What are your projects there? And, what do you find there geologically that's interesting?
My project here, one of the reasons to come was much more about the colleagues who I have a chance to work with. One of the things I use as a particular tool to look at how quickly the surface of the Earth is moving, how quickly rocks are being exhumed or eroded. And so there's some specialized instruments and faculty who specialize in that here in France. And so it's a bit more about kind of building technique and learning new methods than it has been on particularly the geology of Brittany. But having never been to the coast of Brittany before, I can say it's absolutely spectacular and not to be missed. So if you're in this part of the world, come check out the rocks and the coast here in Western France.
Does the University of Michigan still come down to Park City to stay? Because I know in years past I've seen the vans at Chateauprix, or are you solely based out of Camp Davis?
Now we still travel around quite a bit. I don't know that we've been to Brighton in a couple of years, but we've been to Dinosaur National Monument. We've been into the Uintas. We go look at the huge phosphate mine there on the south side of the Uinta Mountains, and we drive through Sheep Canyon and talk about all the geologic rock layers there and the deformation associated with that range. So we still spend time in Utah. We haven't done Brighton in a couple of years, but I hope we'll return to that again.
How long has the University of Michigan had Camp Davis?
The property itself, the university has owned since 1929. So we're going on almost 100 years. So it started off as an engineering camp. It was for civil engineers who had to learn surveying. The geologists started using it a little bit in the 30s. And then there was an explosion of use actually during World War II. They had to train geologists to find petroleum, and they had to train female geologists. And so Camp Davis was the center of bringing women into the field of geosciences during the war effort to become petroleum geologists. And so a number of them had gone on to remarkable careers. And then it became basically a fully geological field station in the 50s. And so civil engineering kind of phased out manual surveying as a requirement for students in the 50s and 60s. And we've been a geological field station since that time.
Well, knowing that the field camp is the Davis Field Station is in one of the most expensive real estate areas in the country, it makes me wonder. I mean, knowing that you've had it for 100 years, I'm sure you bought it for pennies on the dollar, or the university did, but I'm kind of curious how many acres it is and where is it exactly in relation to Jackson.
So we have 129 acres. It was a homestead. It was a home, piece of homesteaded property in which the homesteaders gave up on it. And so it defaulted back to the U.S. Forest Service. And at that particular time, if my memory serves me, don't hold me 100% to account, I believe that the governor, the vice governor, and the state geologist of Wyoming were all Michigan grads. And so they worked out a land swap with the Forest Service. And so the Forest Service got some property in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. The University of Michigan got this 129-acre homestead just south of Jackson Hole. So if you know the area, and your listeners might well, if you head south of Jackson a little ways along the Snake River, there's a little junction or hamlet called Hoback. It's where the Hoback River meets the Snake River. And if you turn and travel about 5 miles up the Hoback River, that's where you'll find Camp Davis. We actually, our property straddles the Hoback River, and we back right up onto the Bridger-Teton National Forest.
I'm sure we've all passed that a number of times.
Yeah, beautiful.
Well, Nathan, as we are all out scurrying about in the Wasatch Mountains and we come across a group of students, should we talk to them? Can we engage with them? What should we ask them? Because I'm going to want to know what they're looking at.
Oh, the students love to be talked to, in my experience. And I think, well, at least for my group of students, it never ceases to amaze them how many people will yell "Go Blue" at them as they're hiking through Grand Teton National Park. But after they yell that, they're very curious about what the students are doing. And I think particularly for students from the Midwest, you will not have much effort figuring out what institution they're from. They'll be covered with M's or O's or I's or N's. Feel free to ask them what they're doing out there. Feel free to ask them what they think about this part of the world, because for many of them, they're probably having new thoughts about what it is, what our country is like, and what the geology of the planet is like. And they love to try and explain what they've learned to other people.
Well, our guest has been Nathan Neamey. He's a professor and director of the Camp Davis Field Station through the University of Michigan. Nathan, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio. What a great conversation.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Carbon dioxide is the greenhouse gas that most of us think of and where most of the research and funding is going. But there is another greenhouse gas that is just as critical and potentially harmful, methane. And thanks to the research being done through the Swanson Group at the University of Utah, biological methods for removing excess methane from the atmosphere are being created. Here to tell us what these microbes are and how they can help combat climate change is Jessica Swanson, Assistant Professor of Chemistry, Director of the Swanson Group, and developer of this new methane mitigation process. Jessica, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
To start with, congratulations on being named a 2024 Cottrell Scholar by the Research Corporation for Science Advancement. And they say the money that you receive is going towards your work in bacterial methane oxidation.
Yeah.
Was this a big deal? I hope so.
Yeah, it was a really nice boost towards this research. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, before we talk about the research, tell us about methane. We are all very familiar with carbon dioxide, and I think that's the one that gets obviously most of the coverage. But what is methane as compared to carbon dioxide?
Yeah, it seems to be the ignored brother or cousin or however you want to call it. So methane is a big deal, and increasingly recently, I think people are recognizing that if we want to slow down what people call near-term warming, which is how warm it gets over the next 5 to 10 years, methane is really the main handle that we have to do that. One of the reasons is that methane is more potent than carbon dioxide on a per molecule basis. So if you look at a 20-year time span, methane creates about 80 times as much warming as carbon dioxide on a per molecule basis. Over 100 years, that decreases to between 28 and 34 times, but it's still more potent.
So what are the sources for methane? I mean, again, we're very familiar with carbon dioxide, burning fossil fuels and whatnot, but where do we get methane from?
Yeah, there's lots of sources, some anthropogenic or coming from humans and some natural, about 60-40 split. The main ones that we would be familiar with, first off, is natural gas, right? So natural gas is methane. So all of the heating of our homes, even when we're burning gas stoves in our kitchens, the methane that's not burnt in that process does leak out a little bit. And there are increasing kind of concerns over the health issues related to not getting clean air into your homes. But larger leaks come from the extraction of natural gas. So these new processes of fracking, they will all, at various points in the extraction and transportation process, there will be leaks, transient leaks. But it's really all over the place. So even oil and gas, as we're extracting oil, of course, we're also pulling up the methane along with it. And very rarely is that something that's captured and used as natural gas. Sometimes it's vented off. Sometimes it's what we call flared, where people will ignite it, basically. And you see this in refineries, actually. If you drive by a refinery and see a big flame coming out of a tall tube, that's methane and other gases being flared off or burned off. That flaring process does convert it mostly into carbon dioxide, although it's never perfect. So the best flares will get about 92-94% of the methane. But there's also lots of sources from agriculture. So not just the cattle that I think a lot of people hear about. So cattle and all ruminants are animals that digest their food in two stomachs. And the first one uses microbes to break down cellulose and fibers that we can't break down. And a natural byproduct of that is methane. So they're breathing out methane, but also the manure processing on the other side, that also releases methane. So essentially anywhere you have biomatter that's breaking down, microbes are involved in that. And some of the microbes doing that are releasing, they're called methanogens, they're releasing methane. So ironically, rice farming is one that produces a lot because you have this process where standing water comes in and these methanogens will be breaking down biomatter and they don't need oxygen to do it. The bacteria that we work with are the competing bacteria, if you will. They're called methanotrophs, and they sit kind of on top of the methanogens, and they consume or eat methane as their sole food source. That's how they survive. But the rub is that they need oxygen. So the methanotrophs have to sit at this in-between layer where they can get enough oxygen to oxidize methane and they consume the methane. So they typically lose out and there's more methane that's released from these standing water areas.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Jessica Swanson. She's an associate professor of chemistry at the University of Utah. She's the director of the Swanson Group. And we're talking about this new methane mitigation process that she is in charge of, that she is using all of her time to do more research about and try to find more efficient ways to use these methanotrophs. Did I say that correctly?
You got it. Yeah.
It's so interesting. First of all, I just want to go back to, it was probably 25 years ago when we first started, or, you know, the lay people among us started hearing about methane. And, you know, there was this big hole in the ozone over New Zealand because all of the sheep that produce all of this methane. And so when you look at that sort of thing, how does that stack up? You know, was that just sort of a myth, an urban myth, or how does that stack up to other sources of methane?
Yeah, so the ozone depletion was a very serious issue and remains kind of an issue that people need to stay aware of. Ozone is one of byproducts of atmospheric chemistry, and actually methane, the natural cycle for it to be converted into carbon dioxide, that's a natural process, is also by radicals, but in lower levels of the troposphere, where it will run into a hydroxide or a chlorine radical, and that will convert it naturally into carbon dioxide. That's a natural life cycle for methane in the air. But the immediate concerns with ozone depletion are not so direct. There's new work that's coming out where people are looking at increasing the amount of radicals in the air to deal with the methane overabundance in the air, because the atmospheric levels are really almost on an exponential growth at this point. And we're really hopeful that that's going to work. And some of the projections say that will work great. And some of the projections say that may tamper with the ozone layer. So people are trying to be very cautious on that scale of approaches.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. So these bacteria, these methanotrophs, remind me of the bacteria that you put in like your septic system or something like that. But how were they first developed?
They exist everywhere. They're all across the earth, wherever biomatter is being broken down. These methanogens will show up to eat biomatter, and methanotrophs will show up pretty quickly to consume the methane. And so there's many different strains of methanotrophs and methanogens out there, some living in soil, some living in water, some living even in tree bark they found. So they're all over the place. I am one of, you know, a vast number of people that are working in the methanotroph field, and one of my collaborators, I'm very lucky to be working with Mary Lidstrom at the University of Washington, and she has a particular strain that's very efficient at consuming methane, especially at the lower concentrations that we need to handle.
So Jessica, your big focus is developing more of these methanotrophs, and in reading for this interview, finding that what's typically out there for the methanotrophs, they eat methane, or they digest methane slowly, there's not that much of it. What is it about the methanotrophs that you're developing that will make the process more effective?
Yeah, so we're really, and again, we're working with many people on this. We're computational biophysicists. We use simulations to characterize all the processes involved. And what we're trying to find is, where are the limitations? If we can increase the efficiency of these methanotrophs, particularly in the low concentrations, because as soon as methane is released from any of the sources, it gets very diluted in the atmosphere, right? And so there are plenty of technologies to deal with high concentrations of methane, like pure natural gas, that's great. When it gets down to these lower concentrations, there's just not many solutions, especially in the 10 ppm to 3000 ppm range. And yet there's a lot that's being produced in that range. And so we're trying to just increase the efficiency by about 10 to 20-fold. And if we can do that, then we would have some really stellar technological solutions for taking those waste streams and turning them actually into valuable products.
So how does that look physically? Is it a spray that you would put over a rice field? Is it a tower that's sucking in that methane from the atmosphere? What does that commercial product look like?
Yeah, so the way that they're called bioreactors, and the way that they used to make them was kind of, aqueous beds of these bacteria. What we're trying to develop is more of an efficient thin film approach, where the air would basically go into a big container, and the size of that bioreactor container depends on what the source is, larger for larger sources. And all the air has to do is trickle through, these stacked layers of these methanotrophs that will, as the air passes by, take up the methane, consume it, turn it into their biomatter, their little cells factories, right? And then as the air comes out of that tractor, you've now removed the methane. So that's the idea. And then over time, you can take those bacteria, dry them, and the most obvious product that we're aiming for is just creating a single cell protein that they're already using this to feed fish, to feed some swine. So there's a lot of different uses of single cell protein. And then there's other hopeful products that would be upcycling the carbon to things like bioplastics and biofuels, so more valuable products.
Wow, that's so interesting. So Jessica, it sounds like obviously what you're doing is trying to create efficiency in something that gets rid of the methane or makes it dissipate. There are also these processes like an anaerobic digester, these huge kind of industrial composting type things where the methane is captured and then created fuel is able to be created from that escaping methane. So your process is sort of eating the methane and making it, dissipate or go away. And then there are other sources or other processes that are actually harnessing the power of the methane.
Yeah. And thank you for asking. I think that's a really important distinction to make. Yeah. So landfills is a great example of a huge source of methane. I don't know if you've ever driven by and seen the little pipes sticking out of the landfills that are kind of leaking out. So you're right. So some people, they will take collected methane like that and they'll use it as an energy source. The problem is you need it to be pretty concentrated to use it as an energy source. So that rules out, when you see little vents in landfills, those are just too dilute. So a lot of sources are too dilute to turn it back into some kind of useful energy. In fact, even when people flare it, they just burn it, right? They have to get the concentration up to about 10%. And the concentrations that we're talking about are like 0.01 to 0.1 up to maybe 1%. So very, very dilute. So those waste streams, it's really hard to do anything with them. A lot of mitigation technologies are just looking for ways to oxidize. Basically, can we use the catalyst, a photocatalyst or a thermocatalyst, just to turn it into carbon dioxide? And the beauty of using biology in this way is that, yeah, you can actually now harness the carbon and turn it into something that hopefully is a little, stays out of the atmosphere a little bit longer and has some value to it. So kind of a green product.
Right. So interesting. So going back to what you initially said about methane being sort of the forgotten, stepbrother, why is that? Considering that it was the statistic you gave 80 times more sort of potent than carbon dioxide.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not as concentrated in the atmosphere. To date, it's contributed about a third of the warming that we've seen. So it does contribute a fair amount, and not as much as carbon dioxide. Now, I wouldn't say that, methane needs to get all the attention, because carbon dioxide is still absolutely the issue. And we still have to get carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. But we have the opportunity to have a faster impact with methane, and we can't ignore methane because it is so potent. And sadly, we are seeing this rapid rise in atmospheric levels. And that's not just from increased anthropogenic sources. They don't know exactly, but they know that based on the isotopic levels in the methane that's in the atmosphere, a lot of the new methane is coming from biological sources. And so what people think, unfortunately, is there's a positive feedback that with warming, we have more methane production from a lot of natural sources, wetlands. And of course, the one people have heard about is permafrost. As you have frozen ground and tundra that thaws, you have the breakdown, rapid breakdown of a lot of biomatter, and then releases. of methane. It makes it both really important on the one hand, and to me, it gives me a lot of hope, because I think it's an area that with the right focus, maybe we can have an impact.
Well, Jessica, these methanthropes, they're bringing in the methane and they're converting it to carbon dioxide and this protein. Does that conversion just release more carbon dioxide out into the atmosphere, or are you able to actually physically capture it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that as well. So for every two methane molecules that go in, because of the metabolic process, one will be released as carbon dioxide, but the other one turns into the proteins and the lipids and all the biomolecules that make up that bacterial cell. And that's what you can then pull out and turn into a product. Yeah, so that's what I love about this potential solution, is that you can pull the carbon out of the atmosphere for a longer period, as opposed to just immediately oxidizing it into carbon dioxide.
Well, and you mentioned there's different strains of methanthropes. How differently do they react with the methane?
Yeah, there's a huge number of strains, and so many that are out in the environment that people haven't even characterized yet. They all act in a similar way, but they all have variations. So the particular strain that we're working with that is so efficient for some reason at the low concentration levels is a haloalkylophile. So it really loves salts and it loves a basic solution. So that's one of the things we're trying to uncover, is why is it that these conditions and this particular strain is better, and how can we pull out the aspects that make it better and utilize those to increase the efficiency?
Jessica, one of the things that I'm hearing you talk about is these innovative solutions to our changing climate. And it's so much, you know, so many people feel helpless, but you are really making this positive change that's using, you know, innovation and efficiency and chemistry in your case to tackle this huge issue facing our world right now. And it's really exciting for hopefully our listeners, but certainly for Katie and me to sit here and listen to you talk about. You teach a course, a GE course at the U called Chemistry for a Better Future. And I can only imagine how much you're turning on young people to this whole world. Can you just tell us about the course?
Yeah. Thank you for asking. So that was part of the Cottrell Scholar Award, was actually the creation of this course, because I feel exactly what you're saying. I feel like so many people in all tracks of professions in life want to contribute to solutions and just don't know how to. And that's a very demoralizing place to be. And so I taught a course at the University of Chicago for a number of years that was Chemistry for Alternative Energy Economy. It was basically focusing on the basic science of all the cool alternative energy solutions, right? So this course is aimed at doing a similar thing, but for a broader audience. Talking to people in business and marketing and really any area, and giving them the foundation that they need to understand kind of the science behind the challenges we're facing with climate and other environmental challenges that we're going to face in the future, and motivating them with all the different ways that they can be part of the solution. A big motivator for me was listening to this podcast called My Climate Journey, which does a similar thing. You can hear these weekly podcasts where you hear about people who are coming up with very creative, innovative solutions. And I think we just need to get those possibilities out to our students and our community in a broader way.
Absolutely. Well, this being the kind of issue that is facing every one of us on the planet and how big it is, I can only imagine that there's a lot of funding out there for someone like you to be able to find. Is there a lot of competition? Or, you know, what is the landscape out there for people competing for funding? And then, you know, for someone like you, do you find it easy? It just seems what you're doing is so promising.
It's rapidly changing. And I guess that's the nature of climate in general. I think for a very long time, and I'm new to the methanotroph methane area, only, you know, as of 2 years ago, did my group dive into this. We have fundamental, you know, methods and skills in other areas, and I just wanted to find a way to contribute. But for a very long time, there's been a huge field of people who want to do something with this research, but they've been surviving on a trickle of funding, right? And so the expertise is spread out. As people are recognizing how important this is, funding is starting to pick up. And it's picking up rapidly. And I'm very hopeful that we can use that to catalyze solutions and get them out there more quickly. Because at this point, you know, with the team that I have together, we know we can make these bioreactors. We're not idea limited. We're just funding and time limited. So as soon as we can get the right investors in place, we can make this roll, right? But if we don't, then it's going to die in the lab, right? And that's really tragic because it is a potential solution, you know, and it could make a big dent in the end. So yeah, it's an exciting and still a little bit tenuous because we haven't landed all of the funding that we need to move it forward as quickly as we'd like.
Well, speaking of your team, endeavors like this are always so multidisciplinary. You know, your chemistry, you're working in molecular biophysics, which brings in at least two or three other fields. Who are you collaborating with and what departments and disciplines are part of this team?
Yeah, that's really critical. So I've been very fortunate to team up with Mary Lidstrom, like I said, from University of Washington, and she is arguably like the field's leader in methanotrophs. Mary is a very deep, deep trough of wisdom when it comes to these methanotrophs, and she is the one that has this specialized strain. So it's been really rewarding because I come at it from a very different perspective. I think about things on the molecular level and what's driving the physical processes, and Mary knows the bacteria really well. So that overlap generates a lot of ideas in terms of how can we look at this in a different way to find new solutions. And we're also working with Amy Rosenzweig, and she is, sorry for the chime, she is the field's leader in understanding the oxidation complex itself, the actual enzyme that oxidizes methane. And so it's wonderful to be engaged with people who know these systems so well.
When do we expect to see this as a viable commercial product? Because it sounds really exciting and so essential.
We are hopeful in 3 years. So we're looking for an initial big hit that will push us from lab to pilot stage. And then we'd like to be deploying these things thereafter. To have the impact that we want to have, we need to start getting them out there, you know, within 4 to 5 years, and then rapidly scaling up the numbers that are out there. And that's kind of, you know, I get excited about a lot of things, but to me, that's one of the exciting prospects is once you start developing these bioreactors for the larger methane sources, they can come in so many sizes and scales. You could eventually imagine these things being hooked onto buildings wherever you're processing air. You could hook them up to your, you know, your home garden, wherever you're breaking down biomatter, right? They could come in much smaller scale where individuals could play in and partake in this green solution. That's not going to be possible until we get, you know, the efficiency and the technology down to the level that even makes any kind of financial sense for individuals. But it could go in many directions, and especially when we can figure out how to upcycle the carbon into bioplastics and biofuels, you can start to make a lot of really valuable things out of what is currently causing global warming.
Well, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you if you could briefly go over the commercialization process from the University of Utah. We've learned on this show how much the University of Utah really supports the work and has sort of a streamline or an avenue for you to take your products into the commercial space.
Yeah, and we are just engaging in that. I can tell you this energy accelerator has been definitely a catalyst. It's wonderful to be engaged with people who want to help us because we're scientists. We cannot do that, play that side of the game. We need people to help guide us through how we get this to the stage that it can be deployed in the marketplace and in an effective way. So Mary has been really happy to engage with the University of Utah because we do have this support here. So fingers crossed, it's amazing. I've also been, you know, really impressed with the Wilkes Center. I don't know if you guys have engaged much with them, but they're also bringing a lot of energy to this domain. So that's been helpful.
Well, Jessica, we will leave links to your lab and some of the work you're doing on our website. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. This is really important work. Congratulations on the award. That's a really big deal. I was reading about that. And as this develops, come back on and tell us more.
Wonderful. I would enjoy that. Thank you for having me.
And again, Jessica Swanson, really interesting, cool science today. Just to wrap up a few things here with Cool Science Radio, you want to tune in next week. We get the best space update from the senior editor of space, essentially, at Scientific American magazine, Lee Billings. There is no one that can talk about space in a more interesting way, right, Katie?
And there were so many interesting things going on and data behind the OSIRIS-REx mission and what the next space probe is looking at. There's always something fascinating that he has to say.
Right, and the next solar storm and what else? He talks about space junk and actually something fell out of the sky.
Yep.
It was a discarded crate with some batteries from the International Space Station that made it into low Earth orbit. Not a good thing because those things are supposed to burn up before they come into low Earth orbit, and it actually hit a house in Florida.
All of our listeners know, stuff burning up in low Earth orbit isn't good either.
Yeah, no. So he'll talk about that and lots of other things. Also, tune in next week on Cool Science Radio. We'll be speaking with a local Park City resident, Brett Trowbridge, who is a CEO of a company that does this wild, has this wild science behind toxic soil cleanup in industry. So that'll be interesting. Always fun to find out what people do here in Park City to make their life and livelihood here.
And if you're looking and if you're starting to plan summer events, do not let the Astronomy Festival in Bryce Canyon pass you by. It's June 5th through 8th, sooner than we thought. So start marking your calendars and plan a trip to Bryce National Park for their annual Astronomy Festival. We will have some guests on later in May to talk about what to expect.
Yes, but do plan that. June 5th through 8th. It starts on a Wednesday, ends on a Saturday. They bring their telescope. It's free. But you need to make your plans to be there.